Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get started again. I want to encourage everyone who has a question to begin to line up. We'll try to go as quickly as possible in this last session of the evening. So again, if you do have a question, there are microphones on either end of the auditorium.
The beginning and the end, and you'll be fresh.
We do want to encourage those who are in our lobbies to come on in to the auditorium. If you are in the lobby and you can hear me, come on into the auditorium so that we can move expeditiously. I know this is a school night for some, and so we want to encourage you to come on in so we can conclude our final session. Again, it's been a long day, especially for Dr. Singer and Dr. Patrick. This is their third talk and presentation. Quite honestly, I am surprised that they have the energy that they do, and I just want to thank them again for coming all the way to Detroit, Michigan. Give them both a big, big hand of appreciation. It has been very provocative dialogue, and we hope that your questions will allow it to continue. Again, if you're just entering into the auditorium, this is our Q&A time where you're allowed to ask your questions. There are microphones on either end of the auditorium. Please make sure you state your questions succinctly. Earlier today, the rules were you can ask a one-sentence question so you can get a one-sentence answer. I think everyone broke the rules, so we won't restate those, but try your best to be succinct. Joining us on stage is Dr. Jim Bowl. He is the medical director for Angela Hospice and has operated in that capacity full-time since 2000. He is also double board certified in family practice and hospice and palliative medicine. He received his education from the University of Michigan and very own Wayne State College of Medicine. Give him a hand for that. He is taught at the University of Detroit Mercy. I should back away from this microphone. Okay, I'll just try to use a loud voice while the sound system comes back. But Dr. Bowl has taught at the University of Detroit Mercy and Wayne State University College of Medicine, and he has done genetic research as a part of the Human Genome Project at the National Institute of Health. Currently, again, he is the medical director for Angela Hospice. Can you give Dr. Jim Bowl a big hand? Sitting to my far right is Professor Bruce Russell. As many of you know, again, he has been a part of the philosophy department here at Wayne State University for over 30 years, 10 as chair. He graduated from the University of California at Davis with a BS in mathematics and a PhD in philosophy. His areas of specialization are epistemology, ethics, philosophy of religion, and philosophy of film. He has published several papers on the problem of evil and an entry on a priori justification of knowledge in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, a paper comparing moral and epistemic duty, and several papers on the philosophical limits of film. He has been a fellow in the medical ethics at the University of Tennessee at Memphis and at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Russell has been an active participant in various events dealing with religion, science, and philosophy over the years. Give Dr. Russell a big, big hand, if you will. Earlier today, we were able to hear some from Dr. Russell, a little bit from Dr. Bowl, but you feel free to offer your questions, and gentlemen, feel free to add on to any comments that you would like. We'll start here with our first question.
My question is for Dr. Singer. You stated that the potential of the fetus, potentiality of the fetus, is not enough to prohibit abortion. And your defense appeals to consequentialist considerations, and I think you're really worried about the hazards of overpopulation in the future. So let's say 2050. I think that's the year that you mentioned. But many of us here are not going to be alive in 2050, so I think you're really considering the interests of future persons. But if it is permissible to abort fetuses for the good of future persons, then I think you're giving moral priority to future persons who have not been conceived over fetuses which have been conceived. So I'm wondering if this is a correct implication of your defense of abortion, and if it's not correct, where have I misunderstood you?
Yes, it is correct. It's perfectly true that if we're talking about a being who is not yet conceived but will exist in the future, and I think we can be confident to say that barring some incredible calamity, there will be beings, human beings, and other animals as well, I guess, but anyway, there will be human beings existing 50 years from now. If increasing the world's population now is going to mean that there will be billions of beings living miserable lives, conscious beings who want to achieve things but who can't because of the environmental degradation and collapse of planetary ecosystems, that results from the existence of, let's say, 15 billion people in 50 years from now, I would give that priority over the existence of a fetus who exists now but is not conscious at all and has no hopes or desires or wishes from the future.
Would anyone else like to comment on that question? If not, we'll go to our next question. Oh, there's the gentleman over there.
They're in line first.
No, go right ahead. Go right ahead, sir.
This is a question for Dr. Singer as well. From my understanding of what you said previously, that the moral justification of saving children comes from their intrinsic desire to live, that basically their willingness to go on and to continue to develop is the primary reason behind their death being immoral. If that is the case, and since there is a relative scientific consensus that a portion of our desire for self-preservation is biologically motivated, could it not be argued that a fetus is doing everything that it needs to do to live as well, that innately it's desiring to live, desiring to progress on, just not in a conscious state?
No, I think that to argue in that way would be to confuse two different things. I'm talking about a conscious desire, an awareness of the fact that you exist over time and that you want to go on living and carry out certain projects or hopes and so on. Now, it's perfectly true that that desire exists because throughout evolutionary history, beings who didn't desire to go on living probably failed to survive and failed to reproduce. So in that sense, yes, that desire, like other things, is the product of our evolutionary history. But that doesn't mean that we put it on this, give it the same moral significance as a desire which is not really a conscious desire at all, but is simply a biological tendency, if you like, the way the system is functioning. After all, everything that you said about the fetus, you can also say about a lot of non-human animals. In fact, you could even say it about plants. They are also, in some inverted commas sense, doing things in order to go on living. I mean, the plant sends down its roots to where water is in order to survive. But it doesn't really do that in order to survive in any conscious, purposive sense. It doesn't think, oh, I better get my roots deeper because otherwise there isn't enough water and I'm going to die. And I think it makes a significant difference if a being can do that on the conscious level.
So for moral consideration, the conscious desire and the unconscious desire are separate.
That's right. They're very
right.
Different
Thank
significance.
You.
If I could quickly sneak a question in, and then we're going to go next to our next audience question, and I'll give this question to Dr. Russell. Earlier we asked a question, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. When, if ever, is it justifiable to take innocent human life? What would be your thoughts about that question?
So I'm pretty much with Peter Singer about a necessary condition for what I'll call being morally considerable, so that by that I mean that it's a creature to whom you owe some kind of moral duties if you're morally considerable. And I think you have to be conscious in order to meet that lowest bar. I don't think that it's sufficient, that I think that there are a variety of situations, even if you meet that bar, that maybe more good could be produced if you take the life of a conscious but not self-conscious creature to improve the lives of self-conscious creatures. So now, if you move now up to an innocent human being, where I'll take that to mean an innocent person, some people talk that way, I think I differ from Peter Singer in that I'm not a utilitarian, that I don't think you can sacrifice innocent persons for the good of others. There are unusual situations where if you don't kill one person, six people, including that one person, will die. And if you do kill the one person, the five will live. In that situation, I think it's an exception that you should kill that person, because otherwise all six are going to die. But for the most part, where it's either five or one or something like that, that I think it's wrong to kill an innocent person to save other innocent people. When do you become an innocent person? I think Peter and I differ a little bit there, too. I think you have to be conscious, but 10-year-olds, they're certainly status, they have the status of persons, not just human beings. But I think actually if you have consciousness and potentiality for living, for being a self-conscious being, then you have the same status as one who already is self-conscious. So I don't think potentiality by itself, because I think way early, in pregnancy, that the fetus is a potential person, but not a person. Mere potentiality is going to get you in a lot of trouble, we can talk about maybe. But so I don't think it's sufficient to have potentiality, but I think potentiality plus some other thing, namely consciousness, gives you full moral status, where I think Peter might say that that potentiality doesn't play a role there either. I'm not sure.
Dr. Bowler, if you wanted to just share a quick comment on that, then we're going to go to our next audience question.
Concern in this particular area becomes the issue of what, when we talk about you have to have some sort of self-awareness or sapiency to be considered morally viable to be killed or not killed, the question then becomes, at what point do you become morally viable? What level of self-awareness, knowledge, or even arguably the ability to suffer, which you talked about earlier? Because certainly it's been shown that newborns can suffer. Children before they are born have the ability to suffer. In fact, the mind is not fully developed, I guess they say, now till the age of 26. So at what point then does someone truly become a person? From my point of view, I don't have the ability to effectively draw that bar or that line in the sand. And thus I'm going to err on the side of caution and not consider, if at least three of us, I haven't heard Dr. Russell's view on it, that human life begins at the time of full conception or during the process of conception. That would probably be a very safe bar to say it is now human. And I realize the neurologic system is not well developed there, but since the whole process is gray, to err when it's gray, you err on the side of caution.
Okay, we're going to come back and further this discussion. Let's take another question if we could.
Thank you. As we were just speaking about potentiality, it actually plays into some of my question. It was mentioned by Dr. Singer that you couldn't believe that if people were being euthanized mistakenly, that Belgium would have allowed it in their country. Well, I'm personally aware of many cases where parents were recommended to terminate their pregnancies by their doctors, including some in the same case that you mentioned where they were told that they would have no brain matter. Yet, after refusing to terminate these pregnancies, these parents gave birth to perfectly normal children, many who are actually highly intelligent. And nevertheless, this practice still continues in the United States. So I had a question as to, obviously, clearly these doctors were wrong in their judgment that they had used initially when giving that recommendation to their doctors. So it could either be for Dr. Singer or any of the panelists. Could you please comment on this phenomenon, actually, but that that goes unacknowledged in our country, in the U.S.
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the relationship is that you're trying to draw between the situation in the Netherlands and the understanding of it in Belgium and the situation now, unless it's just that, well, doctors are fallible. I mean, look, I think it's true in any human activity involving large numbers of people. People will make mistakes. The criminal justice system in this country is clearly fallible. And we have documented cases now of people who have been on death row, indeed people who have been executed, who were innocent and proven innocent by DNA tests. That doesn't mean that we have to abolish the criminal justice system. It may mean that we try and improve it so that we reduce the number of these mistakes, but you know, we will keep it going because of the good that we think it does overall, despite some errors. So I think that medicine is fallible. I'm sure the physicians on my left will not deny that. And we should do what we can to reduce those mistakes. But I don't think what you're saying is enough to show that we should, for example, not permit abortions to take place. We should try and improve the advice that doctors give. But sometimes, of course, doctors do just have to talk about probabilities or risks. They can't be sure. And if a doctor says, look, I think there's a 50% chance that the fetus that you're carrying will have this condition, and you know, certainly this used to be the case quite often before we could do certain kinds of diagnoses, genetic diagnoses. And a woman says, I don't want to run that risk. Even though I understand that I have a 50% chance that my child will be normal, I don't want to take the risk of a 50% chance that it won't be. So I'm going to terminate this pregnancy and maybe have another one later. I think that's a reasonable thing for a woman to do.
If I could just have one of you comment on this question, and I'll come to you, Dr. Bull. Earlier, I asked a question about how we should, as a society, care for those who are weak and infirmed among us. I use, for example, those who have Alzheimer's or end-of-life scenarios. What would be your comments and thoughts on that?
I was, this may not sound relevant initially, but I was watching a TV show where the actor Will Smith was on, and he was asked by the commentator how he and his wife have remained married in Hollywood for so long, despite the fact that so many marriages fall apart. And he said, well, what we did is we started our marriage with a proposition is that we take divorce off the table. And not that we're better people and not that we fight less or anything else, but that we know that divorce is not the option we choose as a couple to ever entertain. It obviously could be entertained, but they took it off the table. So the issue then becomes is, as Dr. Patrick has said earlier, is it possible to create a condition for the dying so that they don't want euthanasia? Is it possible to take, if we take euthanasia off the table, then we have to find other ways to care for the dying. And hospice and palliative care, which I'm involved in, has worked very hard at that. And I won't belittle the situation, say that no one, once they have hospice, ever wants, doesn't want to end their life. That would be false. It's rare. Most of my people, even those who are dying, want to continue to live. But what I find it's interesting is that those who don't want to live anymore don't want to do so because of what is generally perceived as excruciating pain. We have fabulous ways of controlling pain. We can take someone's heart out of their body and put it in someone else, and the person doesn't feel any pain during the transplant. What people really want to end their life for is due to a loss of control. It's a loss of control of their body, of the functions they used to have. And so then the question that then gets asked later, is it the doctor's job to give someone that level of control? So as far as how should we care for the weak, I would argue is that we take euthanasia off the table and then offer them every service we possibly have.
Next question, over here to my right.
This question is for Dr. Singer. If I understand you correctly, the criteria that you offered on which basis we ought to ascribe value to human life, whether it be self-consciousness or this ability to determine your own subjective value of life, these seem to be descriptive statements about maybe a subset of the human population. Now, my question to you is, on which basis would you urge me to accept your definition? So in other words, how can I derive a normative or an imperative statement from your criteria? I don't know if you understand me correctly.
I mean, are you asking what's, you know, there was a question from Pastor Brooks earlier about, you know, how would you ground an ethic, given that we think that there are objective truths in ethics, how would you ground it? And I talked about putting yourself in the position of others. I'm not sure whether you're asking me a question about
If I propose a different set of criteria, why should I adopt your criteria over any other criteria?
Well, if I put myself in the position of somebody with unfulfilled projects, wanting to fulfill them, and they die before they can fulfill them, I can see that there's a loss there. I can see that there's something that you would not want. If I put myself in the position of someone who has, let's say, advanced Alzheimer's and no longer any real awareness, I don't think there's a loss there. So I'm applying those sorts of standards. Now, you know, I'm not dogmatically saying that the criteria I've suggested are the only possible ones. Professor Russell has suggested some others. We would need to talk about, you know, what criteria are you suggesting? We would need to talk about them and think about, well, have you picked on something that is important, that would really matter, that if I were in your position, that would make me feel that death was worse, or that I wouldn't want you to act in this way. That's the way the discussion has to go.
I mean, it seems to me that there's...
If we could, real quickly, because we have so many people in line, I need to move on to the next question. But thank you very much for your question. And I want to move over here to my left. And please forgive me, don't want to be rude, but I do want as many people as possible to be able to share their questions tonight.
This is for Dr. Patrick. Suppose that I grant that an embryo at conception has inherent moral worth. Is it not possible that there are situations in which, due to other factors, a reasonable person might decide to terminate that birth, and it would be morally acceptable because of those other factors? And if that's the case, then doesn't the question change to be no longer, is abortion acceptable or not, straight, just like without qualification, and instead, how do we weigh the moral worth of an embryo against other moral considerations?
I have a little difficulty with my hearing at my age, but if I understand you right, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying there are some situations in which a reasonable person would say we should terminate this pregnancy.
Sure.
That's certainly true if your reason, your rationality is that of Peter Singer. I don't see those situations except for the lesser of two evils and any double effect, for instance, treating the mother's cancer leading also to the death of the child. I don't know if that answers your question because I didn't hear it clearly. I'm sorry.
Okay. Going over to my right, sir.
Yes, thank you, Pastor Brooks. Earlier in the discussion, Pastor Brooks, you asked a fourth question. How do we determine the value of a human life? Dr. Patrick, your response that I understood, you said it was a very difficult question, and then I didn't understand much else of what you said. Would you please answer the question a bit more specifically, if you might?
And the question is, how do we determine the value of a human life?
Yes, sir.
I don't think we can. When human life is there, my job as a physician is to care for it in any way that I can until it comes to a natural end.
If I could, Dr. Patrick.
I don't choose to call somebody a person on the basis of a function, but on the basis of who they are, aside from function, that they are human creatures. Because I think there are just so many ramifications from any other choice. Certainly, equality is gone, and that's important to me. So that's the way I go.
Thank you.
Dr. Patrick, if I could, maybe just asking the question in a different way, a little bit different way. Do you believe that human beings have intrinsic value?
Of course, yes.
And if so, on what basis?
Well, of course, as a Christian, I believe we're made in the image of God, and that gives us intrinsic value. Now, obviously, a secularist doesn't believe that. That's another, and the majority of Americans probably do. And so the healthcare system should reflect that reality on democratic grounds.
Dr.
Grounds
Russell.
Of justice.
I want to question whether you really believe that every human life has the same intrinsic value. Because Peter Singer suggested some cases this morning that I think are good ones, namely they'll involve triage situations. You can save 5 babies. The 6th one in this group is has T-Sachs or something like that, some kind of severe defect of some sort, mental probably. And so you can save 5 of the 6, and all the other babies don't have any affliction. Now, do you say, take a 6-sided die, put their names on it, and roll the die? Or do you say, in that case, we have to save the 5 that are not defective?
I would call that a lesser of two evils situation. Certainly with Tay-Sachs.
Well, then, if you don't say roll the die, it shows you're making distinctions.
Yeah, I'm making distinctions which I don't want to, but I'm put in a position where I have to. Those are specially constructed situations. That's not the normal situation. But that's not the one that matters in terms of abortion. Most abortions are done for trivial reasons. That's what I'm concerned about, where we have got to. I started with that. I started with rubella babies, where I made that decision.
It's a counterexample against somebody who says that all human life has the same intrinsic value and can't at the same time say, but in this case that I've imagined, they don't have the same intrinsic value. That's a contradiction.
I'm saying that I'm fallible in that situation, so where I'm forced, I have to do what I think is best, if there is a choice that's forced on me. I'm not pretending that I've got it right.
I don't know what else I can say. It's a contradiction to say all human life has the same intrinsic value, and in sometimes it doesn't have the same intrinsic value.
Well, we'll let you guys continue to debate that after the event, but we're going to take another question over here to my left, sir.
Yes.
And the yes. question will come from the microphone right over
okay,
here.
Okay, thank
could.
You. Yes. Yeah, so I just was wanting to ask, you know, I can understand why a Christian who's trying to model their life after Jesus would then care for those, even if they can't give back. In other words, put yourself in their shoes, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Like Peter Singer agreed, should be a model, regardless of the culture it came from, this golden rule. I could see how Christianity could serve as a sufficient foundation for that. But how can atheism support and motivate the golden rule to love others, even if they can't love you back directly? Could you answer that one for me?
And I'll come back to Dr. Russell, because you discussed earlier this very issue and being trained in philosophy of religion and these issues. How would you explain this question of atheism having a grounding, or Darwinianism having a grounding for caring for others?
Yeah, as a foundation, as a motivation for the golden rule in medicine.
Okay, I have to separate out questions. One is, actually, I don't accept the golden rule. I think it's a mistaken, here's a counterexample to it. It says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I'm a Nazi. I think Jews should be killed. If I turned out to be a Jew or any of my children, I'd want them killed. So I could follow the golden rule and kill Nazis. So I don't think that is actually a sound moral principle. I'll take that, forget it. Let me just grant for the sake of argument that it is. I said earlier today that I thought that they're just moral truths that we can grasp by reason in the same way we grasp mathematical truths or truths about what we're justified in believing. They're very much like truths about what we're justified in doing. So Pastor Brooks asked me this morning about, well, what's the basis? But of course, then I always think that there's not actually some thing or person or something else that's the basis of it. I think it's the basis in reason, the same way that mathematics and principles about what you're justified in believing are based in reason. I don't think that particular golden rule is correct. I just gave you a counterexample to it. But my answer in general is, an atheist can agree that love is a good thing, that happiness is intrinsically good, that it's better to love than to hate, that you ought to help your neighbor. Why not? There doesn't need to be a God for those things to be true. They're true.
Dr. Patrick, if I could just have you just comment for a moment. You mentioned, you quoted earlier today, Alistair McIntyre, on dependent rationality. Can you explain that a little bit, that concept of dependent rationality, especially as it relates to this question of the grounding for objective morality?
Most ordinary people do not analyze the situations they're in. They see a situation and say, that's wrong, that's right. What I believe they're doing is referring to the cultural story within which they've grown up. Like those parents of the little girl I told you about, neither they nor their the fellow members of their tribe thought there was anything wrong with what they did. That was what they would do in that setting. And there are many other examples like that. They are trying to live appropriately. They're doing the human thing, you should do what is right. They thought that was a loving thing to do. Now, I disagreed. And there are many areas in like that. And over time, we look at the outcomes of different societies. One of the ways in which you can see people's decisions is their immigration patterns. They move away from societies that aren't functioning to ones they think function better. The stories are different, and they need to think that through a bit more. Not, stories are not equal. Cultures are not equal. They're different. They're not commensurate.
Question here to my right.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. It seems that especially in Dr. Singer's philosophy, consciousness seems to play a very important role in ascribing worth to an individual. Just in the points of discussion already, we've seen that there's a difference in whether a being is conscious or not. We've all, throughout history, we've tried to answer what consciousness is in different ways. Some people believing that it's just an epiphenomenon of biochemical reactions in a brain. Other people thinking that it's some attribute that is passed on, maybe somewhat mysteriously, to a being from a higher power. My question to Dr. Singer is, if we believe in philosophical materialism, what is consciousness? And why does that attribute particularly carry such weight in discussing morality?
Well, I think whatever philosophical theory about consciousness we hold, we are aware of it. We have first-person understanding of consciousness. And we may have different views about how we explain it, but no philosophical materialist is going to say, I deny consciousness and I'm not conscious. Right? So the philosophical materialist maybe has to give an understanding of how you can explain the phenomenon that we feel, the first-person feel of consciousness, within a materialist framework. That's that philosophical difficulty, and it's an interesting question whether you can do it or not, but I don't need to take sides on that one. I just need to say, we know what it's like, for example, when something hurts us, or when we're distressed in some way, or when we're thwarted in our most important desires. And that's something that we don't want to have, and I think it's something that gives value and purpose to our lives. And I think we all recognize in some way the importance of consciousness. I mean, if you see a stone lying in the street as you're walking home, and you decide to kick it a few times just to entertain you on the boring walk home, nobody thinks you've done anything wrong. If you see a cat lying in the sun, and you have the same attitude to the cat, would be fun to kick this cat a few times as I walk home, I think everybody here in this room would think, well, you have done something wrong. What's the difference? It's clearly the fact that it hurts the cat. The cat is conscious. The cat doesn't hurt the stone because the stone isn't. So I do think that that's at least, that's the floor, that's the minimum, the base from which all values build and flow.
Okay, quickly, question here to my left.
Yes, I want to thank everybody for being here today. This is a very interesting discussion. My question centers on the concept of evil. I noticed that several of the panelists mentioned evils. I would like to know, what is your definition of evil? And also, I understand that Professor Patrick mentioned the doctrine of the fall, which is the Christian's explanation for how evil came into existence, because I think in order for us to come together on these issues, we have got to define what evil is and how it came into existence. in order to determine what is the value of life or anything else?
It's a great question. Didn't direct it to, is that directed towards anyone specifically?
Yes, anyone.
Okay. Well, since these two gentlemen have worked so hard, maybe we'll start with Dr. Russell and Dr. Bowe.
Well, I actually disagree with you that you have to have a definition of evil to make a case about the non-existence of God, say, via the problem of evil, because there are some things that we can't define, but we know clear cases of them. So I think suffering is an evil, creating unhappiness, unfairness, all of those kinds of things are bads or evils. And so I think we don't need a definition of it in order to say those are bad things and we ought to prevent them. You know, the problem of evil is, how is it possible for an all-knowing, all-good, omniscient, all-powerful being to allow so much suffering, in that sense, that sort of evil, of the innocents that we see in this world? That's really a hard thing to explain.
Dr. Bowe?
Basically, the idea of evil within a Christian tradition, it's not, and we've heard a lot of talk today about the idea of sort of a divine mandate, is, you know, if God says it, is it good, or is it good because God says it? Or I may be butchering that because I shouldn't be talking philosophy. However, the Christian actually views evil and good as something sort of intrinsic to us. Paul talks about it in Romans, that the Gentiles know the law because God has written it in our hearts. And Dr. Russell would say that we could come to an understanding of right and wrong, good and evil, perhaps through reason, and I don't disagree with that. But in my experience is that most people have some sort of gestalt of right and wrong, regardless of how much philosophical thought they've put into it. And it does seem that within us, and that there is a built-in sense of right and wrong, and that is ultimately where the Christian sees right and wrong coming from, is from what we might be called a natural law. And then from that, we supplement the scriptures.
All right, next question to my right here.
I have a question for both Dr. Singer and Dr. Voll. I'd like to hear both of their opinions. The Hippocratic Oath says, first of all, do no evil. I am a physician, and I'm approaching euthanasia or killing people from the physician's perspective. Christian physicians have argued that it damages me and my integrity if I stray into the realm of killing a person. And that is because it unearths some hidden tendencies that I have towards selfish intentions that I may not always be honest about. So my question is, does each of you agree or disagree that it damages the person doing the killing if they do so?
I think I missed a word in your last sentence. Do I agree or disagree that it is?
That it damages the person
who does the
action, who does the killing.
I see.
No, I don't agree with that.
And why not?
Well, because I think a doctor who kills a patient who is dying and or incurably ill and has requested over a number of days for the doctor's assistance and has good reasons for not wanting to go on living in that condition, I think such a doctor can feel that he has done what a doctor's duty is, that is, he has acted in the best interests of his or her patient. And I think a doctor can feel perfectly okay about that. And I know there are many doctors who carry out euthanasia in those places where it is legal. And of course, there are some who carry it out in places where it's not legal, which I think is somewhat more dangerous because it's not likely to be as well controlled. But I know doctors who I believe continue to be compassionate, caring physicians doing the best for their patient.
There is a little bit of issue here too, is the idea of, you know, acting in the best interests of your patients is of course the first calling of a physician. However, there is also the issue of, are you acting against your own conscience to do something in that sense? And as I mentioned before, is it possible to take certain alternatives off the table and still act in the best interests of your patients?
Does it do harm to you as an individual? Like, if I were to actually commit euthanasia, would it harm me as an individual? If it was an act that I considered wrong or evil, then yes, I suppose euthanasia or any other action that I did that left me with a sense of guilt or harm would be doing me harm. From a Christian point of view, we would say it might cause some eternal harm or harm to our soul as well. But I think even without that view, one could say doing something that you consider wrong would be damaging to yourself.
Okay. Next question here to my left.
Doctors Russell and Singer, both of you have said that consciousness is a necessary condition for either moral considerability, I think Dr. Russell said that, or valuability, I think Dr. Singer said that. Now, suppose I have a disease, which to me seems perfectly possible, although not actual. Doctors Patrick or Bull could tell me that. Wherein I lose consciousness for, let's say, 9 months every 2 years, like clockwork. Just lose consciousness completely. But then it comes back. Or let's say even 8 hours every night, lose consciousness, like clockwork. Would I thereby lose moral considerability or valuability?
No, the refined position is either conscious or temporarily unconscious.
Right.
Those are the necessary conditions. Yes.
And I agree with that. And I think that's because the desires that you have for the future continue latently, suspended, if you like, while you're temporally unconscious. So that when you awake from that, you will still think, as I awake in the morning, and I still may think about the things that I want to do, which are the same as the things that I wanted to do yesterday before I went to sleep.
And I hope Peter agrees with this. When it comes to animals, they may not have that sense of the future, but even then, if they're temporarily unconscious, but they'll have their joyful life as running through the field as a dog or something, that'll still be reason that they have moral considerability in my terminology.
Okay, because of time, those who are in line now will be our last questions, but we will honor those of you who are already in line. You, sir, here to my right.
I have two questions for Dr. John Patrick, and I understand the constraints.
If we can narrow it down to one,
I didn't mean the pause great. For interjection. In the matter of justice, I'll let him choose between the lesser of two evils. At a mission conference 2 years prior, you had a statement that I regularly deconstruct.
I'm sorry, it's hard to hear you.
I can't hear at all.
I'll come closer. At a missions conference 2 years prior, you had a statement that I regularly deconstruct a woman's right to choose, and it sounded like it was in the clinical context. Could you give an example, an approach, if it differs from what you've mentioned today, if it indeed was in the clinical context?
I'm sorry, they're having a hard time hearing. Is the question about a woman's right to choose?
Dr. Patrick had a statement 2 years ago that he regularly deconstructs a woman's right to choose.
Okay.
It sounded like it was a clinical context. That was the first question. The second
was... Okay, so let me ask the question. He heard you a few years ago in a missions conference kind of deconstruct a woman's right to choose. And it seemed like you
in
were saying that...
In the context of abortion.
Yes, in terms of abortion, correct?
Yeah. It sounded like it was the clinical context.
It sounded like it was in a clinical context. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it takes an hour to do it. It's a long time.
Okay,
then maybe the second question.
If you write to me, I can direct you to where you can find that argument later.
So maybe after we're done, that question you can pose to Dr. Patrick directly.
Where do you think Christians have fallen short themselves in their concept of their own discipline of the Lord or their own suffering at the end of life? And maybe you could incorporate Job or Hebrews.
Okay, so the second question has to do with where Christians have fallen short in their own living out of the end-of-life issues. Is that correct?
The exact words were their own discipline of the Lord or their own suffering at the end of life.
Okay.
We all fall short, of course. I mean, that's the human condition, that our desires to do good always come far short of what they could be. But particularly, I think the church has gone very wrong in the way in which we have allowed death and dying to be taken over by industry, if you like. The vast amount of money that is spent on the American way of dying doesn't need to be spent, and in fact, the last 6 weeks of life for most patients are the time when reconciliation and relationships are restored, and we should be focusing on those and teaching people how to do it. But this guy has more experience of that than me. So.
Dr. Bull, if you could, yeah, comment on that. Where can the church improve in end-of-life issues?
Well, I think, and this would be an interesting area to unpack this debate a little bit more, is when we talk about the value of human life, most Christians do not agree with a philosophical view called vitalism, and that is that life itself is worth, biologic life is worth maintaining at all costs. However, I do see within the pro-life movement a push towards vitalism, perhaps to avoid dealing with the hard middle issues. And so, certainly in end-of-life care, I'm dealt with things all the time. So certainly one issue would be with the church, you know, dealing with the vitalism issue that I feel is in troubling it. And the other issue is that since the church is actually supposed to believe in an eternal life, I see a strange fear of death in certain cases, and a preponderance of desire for miracles and supernatural intervention at the end of life. And I'm certainly not opposed to miracles, I just don't happen to carry them around with me. If God's going to do a miracle, he's going to do a miracle, certainly without my help, or if he so chooses. So the two things I would say, one is the push to vitalism, and the other is the sort of forgetfulness that we have a better life waiting, and that death is a natural part, and that it is okay to let go at some point for that better life.
Okay, coming to my left here, sir.
I've been here all day, and I've been very impressed with the conversations and the debates that have happened. But one thing that I've noticed has kind of stirred me all day has been a certain philosophical argument that's been kind of slandered about but never fully addressed, and that's the principle of double effect as expressed by St. Thomas Aquinas. And I'm curious if the panelists could talk a little bit about that and whether they agree with it or disagree with it, since it makes it's particularly important with end-of-life issues. If a patient is brain dead, is it more acceptable to kill them versus palliatively letting them die without pain? And it also applies to the abortion arena where, you know, or a patient with anencephaly, if they are born into the world, then it's therefore morally acceptable to kill them. And I'm curious if you could address this since it's been such a large portion of Catholic moral thought and thus Western civilization.
Dr. Russell?
So you're asking about the distinction between killing and letting die, right? Oh, and double effect.
Right.
Both of those?
I guess I view the principle of double effect as directly relating to that because...
Okay, so I don't think they're the same issue. So I don't think that there's an intrinsically morally relevant difference between killing and letting die. Why do I think this? Well, it's because of an example. I say to my students, suppose that you had this person come into the hospital, you have five people in need of vital organs, you could kill that person and get the organs to save the five. That didn't seem right. But on the other hand, what if you go down to the cafeteria with that person and you're eating lunch and he chokes on a chicken bone and you could easily give him the Heimlich maneuver, but you think, I guess not. And you intentionally let him die to get the organs to transplant into the five. I see no moral difference between intentionally killing and intentionally letting die in that example. The doctrine of the double effect, it sometimes seems like it has moral significance and sometimes doesn't. So take the case that's often given in Catholic discussions between the cancerous uterus and the breached birth. So the cancerous uterus, if you take out the cancerous uterus to save the mom, foreseeing that the fetus will die, that's one thing, says this doctrine, because it was really foreseen the death and not directly intended. But on the other hand, if you crush this fetus's skull in order to avoid the mother's dying in the breech birth case, that would be wrong because it's causing death in order to save the mom. But the sophists say, what do you say against them? No, we foresaw that the fetus would die when we crushed its skull. What we intended was to reduce the size of its skull. It was a foreseen side effect that it would die, but we actually satisfy the doctrine of the double effect.
Okay. Next question here to my right.
Thank you for taking my question. My question is for Dr. Singer. You stated earlier that we have a population crisis because of resources and whatever the case may be, and abortion was a way to minimize that crisis. My question is, do you believe that the population crisis would go away if humans did not have the issue of greed? Greed takes away and consumes a lot of the Earth's resources. So if that was not the case, would giving be a way to eliminate the abortion process altogether?
So you're saying we wouldn't have a population crisis if there was less greed? Did I hear that correctly?
Resource crisis.
The resource crisis. Right. You had mentioned earlier about resources being consumed because we have too many people.
Okay, so I understand the question, I think. Firstly, let me say, I don't think that, you know, for me, the major reason why I think abortion is defensible is not because we have a population problem. I was using that as a reason for saying that's one reason why I don't think the argument from potential really works, because I don't think, you know, it means bringing more children into existence, and I don't think we want more children as such. But I also said that I think that the same thing can be said about both contraception and refraining from sexual intercourse at a time when, if you have sexual intercourse, you're likely to conceive. And I think that these have the same result. So if, in fact, we were less greedy and we had less of a resource crisis and we could add more resources to have more people in the world, then that would be a reason for saying, other things being equal, it's a good thing to have more people in the world. And then we would think about, well, what's the best way of doing that? Is it by encouraging people to have more children, or is it by discouraging people from having abortions? It might be that we want to do both. That's perfectly possible. But that would just be one factor that would have to be weighed against the reasons why, for instance, a woman didn't want to have children, whether she was pregnant or not. If a woman didn't want to have children, we should listen to what those reasons are. And they might be significant enough to outweigh the fact that by having children, she'll bring a new life into the world who'll be able to enjoy that world and will not, because we're assuming that we have plenty of resources, contribute to a population problem.
Thank you.
Next question.
Well, I guess my question is to Dr. Singer, and I'm not sure if this is exactly or similar to her question, but earlier you stated, like, if there were like 6 million people in the world, then you could see not using abortion, but if there were like we're reaching an overpopulation crisis, so you can see the justification in abortions now, but in a sense it's like saying that, well, there's less people, now the embryo has, or the fetus has value now, but then now when there's more people, they no longer have that value. It's kind of like you're saying, one has value when there's less people, then they don't have value when there's more people, because now we can just expose of them because there's so many people here. Okay. But at the same time, the question I'm really asking is that, I think, in my opinion, abortion is a band-aid to the bigger problem. I mean, because it's like when people have abortions, just like Dr. Patrick said, a lot of the abortions are trivial. It's not that the contraceptive didn't work, or maybe they were raped, or some form of incest that produced the abortion. A lot of it is irresponsibility on current human themselves, you know, with the irresponsibility when it comes to sexual activity. And do you agree with that? Instead of making the human responsible, you're kind of like saying, just do an abortion, but you're putting a band-aid to the bigger problem.
You know, if I could, because we've kind of got this question in different forms throughout the day and throughout this evening, instead of repeating that, because I think you would say that it is bigger than just the abortion issue, she brings up a very good point on does the size of the population change the value of the embryo?
Right. I think it's necessary for my view that while I think that it's a good thing that there should be human beings living good lives, I don't think that the embryo itself has intrinsic value. I think I'm talking here about the argument for potential that says it's a good thing that there are future human lives, so if something has the potential to be a human life, then it's a good thing to allow it to develop into a human life. That's not the same as to say that the embryo has intrinsic value. And in fact, I don't think the embryo as it exists has intrinsic value.
Okay, next question.
Dr. Singer, you mentioned earlier in regards to consciousness, that consciousness would be stated as someone who would have aspirations, hopes for the future, even potential contributions to society, instead of just a purely existing state where you would find in an embryo a younger child or even those who are in a vegetative state. Through my role, actually I'm a youth pastor, I've come across many young people who have never been taught how to think rationally about their lives to come up with morality for themselves, but also have not been put in a position to where they've had aspirations for their lives, but that they simply exist. They eat because people eat. They desire to have sex because everyone around them has sex. But when I ask them, what do you want to do with your life? Their answer is to stay alive. What? How would you define them as existing?
Okay. It's an interesting question, but let me just clarify one thing. The ideas of having aspirations and hopes for the future is not a requirement of consciousness. It's a requirement of self-consciousness or self-awareness, which I think both Professor Russell and I have, if you like, this basically two levels of moral significance. I mean, there may be more, but at least two. One is having consciousness, and the dog or the cat or the pig certainly has consciousness because it can feel pain, even though it doesn't have these other aspirations you're talking about. Then on top of that, as well as consciousness, some of us have self-consciousness or self-awareness, which includes these aspirations for the future. So the people that you're talking about that you've seen are certainly, of course, conscious, but I think they're certainly self-conscious too, in that they can think about themselves and who am I, and they know that, you know, who they are, and they actually, you know that they existed a month ago and they hope to exist next month anyway. But what you're saying is they don't really form long-term aspirations because they perhaps see life as a daily struggle to keep alive, and then they just allow their instincts to eat or to have sex or whatever it is to come out. So I think that they are still self-aware beings whose lives ought to be protected, and it's a tragedy if they're lost. But I also think it's a tragedy that people have to live like that. And I think if you can help them to think about their long-term aims, if you can get them to think about this question that I think Pastor Brooks also said in introducing this session is of ultimate importance, how ought I to live? I wrote a book with that title some years ago, How Are We to Live? I think that's an enormously important thing you can do for them. It goes back to Socrates, who said at the very beginning of Western philosophy, the unexamined life is not worth living. And while I wouldn't go quite so far as to say if these people you're talking about do not examine their lives are not worth living, that's too strong, but I do think that you greatly enrich and enhance their lives if you get them to reflect and examine the way they're living, and they therefore become more autonomous, more purposive, and less subject to the desires that happen to take them at the moment.
Thank you. Thank you. You have the distinction of giving the last question. So it has to be the best one of the day.
No problem.
But no pressure.
So this question is directed to Dr. Singer. And I just want to say thank you for your generosity. I've read a little bit about each person, especially the two main speakers. I know that you're both very generous people with your time and financially as well. Notably, I think Dr. Singer encourages others and himself to increase their giving each year and to keep on with that. There was a gentleman that asked a question over here, and it was about the golden rule. And I felt like at the heart of that question was, how would you motivate atheists to do what you do? Like, where does that come from for you? And I don't know if you can embody like that belief system a little bit. And then also a specific personal question is, this is a personal question, but How do you comfort other people? And how have you done that throughout your life? And have you ever prayed before?
Was the question, how do I comfort other people? Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
Yes, okay. All right. Before I try to answer these difficult questions, which are appropriate ones for last time, let me say, since you were kind enough to say some things about my contributions, let me thank all of those, again, involved in this, particularly Dr. Patrick, of course, who's been with me for all of these sessions. I think you've set up a marvelous forum or set of forums that have really taken us deeply into some issues, and I value the openness and approach that you've all shown in this, and of course the civility with which we've had this discussion, which I wish were reflected throughout the country on the discussion of all of these issues. So, how would I encourage other atheists to do things like give more to the world's poor? I suppose I have two different ways, and you can find them if you want to look at the book, The Life You Can Save. On the one hand, I do appeal directly to what we're achieving. I ask people to think about the fact that for quite small amounts of money, you can save someone's life and think about perhaps what it matters to a family that their child should live rather than die. Think about what it matters that you can help someone to live with dignity because they know that they can support themselves and their family because you've helped them to get what it needs to start a small business or to farm better and produce more food or to get a fair price for their product, whatever it might be, any of those things. Just to think directly what that means. And I think for most people, a lot of people, that's enough. That's a motivation for saying, I've made a difference. I'm really pleased that I've made a difference. I also use a small part of the book, a sort of secondary kind of argument, which is in a way an appeal to self-interest, but to a broader enlightened self-interest. I point out that there's lots of evidence that shows that people who are generous are more content with their lives. If you do surveys where you ask people, how content are you with your life on a scale of 1 to 10, and you also independently ask them, do you give to charity? You get a strong correlation with those who say they're more content with their lives and those who give. And I think that that's understandable given that we are beings who search for fulfillment of various kinds. Now, I don't think, I think that's true of atheists as it's true of theists. We want some kind of fulfillment. I wouldn't say it's necessarily spiritual. Some people would say, of course, theists would be more likely to say it's a spiritual fulfillment. But I would say it's a fulfillment in the sense that we believe we are living to some good purpose. I don't want to go through life thinking, well, what did I do? Look, I had some fun. I had some good times. I lay on the beach and enjoyed the sun on my back. I had some good sex or I enjoyed some good food. And, of course, I consumed a lot of consumer goodies and I, raised my status and was able to earn money and build a big home. In a way, that doesn't seem really deeply satisfying. But the sense that I live my life in contributing in a small way to making the world a better place, that the world is a better place because I lived, because I was able to help others as well as myself, I think is something that is more deeply fulfilling. So that's the kind of thing that I would say to other atheists in terms of why they should give, about those two things. Have I ever comforted people? Yes, of course. I'm a husband and a father, obviously, those that I love and are close to have been in need, and my parents, of course, have both died, and I tried as best I could when they were dying to comfort them. I can't do it by saying, you are going to a better place. I don't believe that. My parents didn't believe that either. None of the people who are really close to me believe that. But I did try to say to my parents, they've lived good lives, worthwhile lives, they've done important things, and fortunately, both of them lived to a reasonable old age. So I think, one can comfort you in saying, well, you've done as well as you can expect humans to do in that respect. So that's what I do. Do I pray? No, I don't pray. I don't believe that there is a being to pray to or any purpose in prayer. It's not something I do.
I want to say thank you to each one of our guests. It's been an extraordinary day in many ways. It's been a very rigorous and provocative discussion that I believe leaves us with two great challenges. The first great challenge that's presented to all of us, whether or not your view or your opinion was changed at all today, is to keep the conversation going and to continue dialogues like this, as Dr. Singer said, in a spirit of civility, that we would engage. We all have the responsibility, regardless of our respective positions, to continue to engage in these dialogues because they are of the utmost importance. At the end of the day, two positions seem to be presented and emerge. Either human beings at various stages have intrinsic value, the traditional Christian position, or they don't, and there are other variables that determine their worth, the traditional atheistic position. But it's important for you to think deeply about these things and not just give yourself over to emotion, but to dig deeply, and that's why we have the resource table out there for you to get those, get that information. The second thing that I would encourage you to do, and I think this is the second challenge to us, is to do more than just think, more than just dialogue, but to act. You know, the question we started with tonight is, how now shall I live? And I put that question to you as we depart tonight. What are you going to do based off of your worldview to make a difference in the world that we all live in? With that being said, I want to thank again Dr. Bruce Russell, Dr. Peter Singer, Dr. John Patrick, and Dr. Jim Bowl. If we could give them all a great big hand this evening. Also, if I could just thank the man who kind of spearheaded and led the way in organizing this event, if we can give a big hand to John Bayon, who works with InterVarsity, the medical and dental students, graduate students. We want to thank John Bayon for his hard work. And we are recording these, and we hope and pray that we'll be able to make these available to the public. You can stay tuned at equippedforlife.tv. That's equipped. forlife.tv, and we'll try to edit these. And I know that Dr. Patrick had his video team from Augustine College with him as well, so you can follow both organizations. With that being said, have a wonderful night.
Can we give you a hand?
That's permissible. Thank you, and have a wonderful night.